You are listening to Dishin' and Swishin', the world of women's hoops, on hoopfeed.com.
Hi, everybody. This is David Siegel welcoming you to this week's Dishin' and Swishin' podcast on HoopFeed. And this week, I'm pleased to welcome back to the podcast one of my favorite writers, Michelle Vopel from ESPN, to just schmooze, to be honest with you. That's what we're going to do this week. Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Hey, David. How you doing?
I appreciate you taking some time and to talk with us, and we might as well start right away with the big elephant that was in the room that now seems to be finally making her way towards the exit, so to speak. And let's talk about the interstate situation. And finally, somebody seemed to feel and realize what they were doing was just really a fiasco.
Yeah, Kansas State announced today that they'd they'd amended their procedures, if you will, which is essentially, we've added on some bureaucratic language to supposedly explain why we didn't do the right thing 2 months ago. But you know what? It's done, and that is the best news, which is that this young woman, who I think really has been through a very needless last 2 months of a lot of worry and a lot of uncertainty, we'll be able to, now figure out where she wants to go, or at least, start the process of that. So that's a good thing, and then Kansas State can move on, and they have a new coach and a new direction they want to take their program, and unfortunately, I think they got off onto a really bad start for that. But now they're hopefully that's resolved, and both parties are ready to move on.
Looking at this from both sides for a second now. You mentioned new coach and all, with Mitty taking over now. What kind of impact do you think this will have in the short term on recruiting?
I think that that's hard to say because, it depends on how the recruits view what happened. And that may depend on how the people who are advising them view what happened. If you're a kid in the Midwest, you may look at the situation and say, well, I don't know that that would really apply to me because I can't quite put myself in Letty Romero's shoes. That's what kids may think. I think other kids may look at this and say, hey, this shows me how you might get treated as an athlete there, and that worries me, and I don't want to go there. So my honest answer is I'm not sure, because you'd have to sort of get into the heads of recruits to try to figure out, how they viewed this. I do think that youth coaches, AAU coaches across the country were paying attention to this, and I think it definitely alarmed them. And they have a lot of influence on kids and what they decide to do. So at this point, Jeff Mitty is in, think it's safe to say he's in, recovery mode, trying to get past this and trying to establish relationships in the Midwest and keep the relationships he had as coach at TCU. But it's definitely, not the way you would want to start your new job, that's for sure.
Well, this seems to be, with social media growing and them being such an integral part of, all things, everything these days. There were some issues with transfers earlier this year, supposedly with Duke not allowing people. There were some questions about some of the things that have gone on at various other schools with disallowing or people wanting to transfer and all of that situation. Is this something that needs to be better watched and controlled, legislation possibly changed by the NCAA? It seems to me that like a lot of common sense seems to fall by the wayside when it comes to letting people out of the scholarships.
Yeah, I think from the start, David, this whole thing there was two tracks here. One was the bigger picture in terms of the inconsistencies of the transfer rule, and we could name so many of them, both in women's basketball and then outside of women's basketball. A real good example is why did Diamond DeShields get an unrestricted release when her coach is still there, is coming back, and then Letty Romero was not released to any four-year school when her coach had been fired. People look at that and say, hey, this doesn't add up. It doesn't make any sense. And the NCAA was essentially absolving themselves of any responsibility by saying, well, hey, we set certain transfer rules, but we allow the school latitude in terms of whether they release people. So if you're a student-athlete and your school does what Lady Romero's school did, which was deny your release, you go through an appeal process, which, frankly, I think is questionable, considering that they didn't have to explain their decision either, then where does a student-athlete go? I mean, the only place a student-athlete can go at that point really is the media and hope that there's enough, positive pressure from the media in the favor of the athlete to maybe make the school change their mind. And that's what happened, I think, in this circumstance. So there's that, the big picture that you're talking about do we need to take a harder look at transfer rules and how they are so inconsistent? And I would say the answer is yes, and I think that's one of the things that's coming. The second tier of this, though, was very specific to this process in Kansas State and this student-athlete. And so in writing about this, I was trying to cover both things, which is the big picture, and then also how the school handled this. And they handled it just completely wrong from the start. There was bad communication. There was assumptions. But the main thing, David, I mean, the absolute, if you want to go to the nugget of what happened wrong with Kansas State, it was when you have an athletic director makes the initial decision to deny her release completely, not just block a few schools, complete denial of release, and not talk to her. And that, to me, was the start of all the problems, was that lack of communication.
And, you know, you would, again, like I said, you would have thought that common sense would have prevailed in this, and the AD would have realized, you know, even if it were to sit down and say, hey, give the coach a chance. You haven't even had a chance to meet him, which I'm sure was what he was hoping to achieve, was to give the coach a chance. Whether I just don't understand how you can do that do the type of unilateral decision, like you said, without talking to the player. I mean, that just seems very commonsensical, but we know that sometimes is lacking in all facets of life, not just in basketball.
I think you're right. And I think people who can be very good at their jobs at times can make nonsensical decisions. And that's where you kind of, you know, you hope the people around them, you hope the process of the bad decision can be reversed in other ways. This was compounded because first you have an initial bad decision. Letty Romero did certainly interact with Jeff Mitty. And both of them, if you talk to them, which I have talked to both of them, don't have anything bad to say about the other one. It was just not a good fit for her. And part of this is, you know, put yourself in her shoes. I mean, she's 18 years old. She came all the way from the Canary Islands to play for this coaching staff. And right after a season-ending loss, which was a pretty emotional loss, by the way, it was to the arch-rival Kansas in overtime in the Big 12 tournament, right after that, the head coach is fired. And then you get all this uncertainty. Who's going to be the new coach? Then you get a new coach. She just doesn't feel comfortable, and she asks for a release. I would say if you polled most of the people, I'd say all the people who follow women's college basketball, I would say most would say, okay, that doesn't surprise me. Nobody would have been like, oh, wow, what's wrong with Kansas State that she wants to leave? It made sense that she would want to leave. What didn't make sense then, though, is I really believe they thought that she wasn't making up her own mind, that she was being controlled or manipulated by a member or members of the former coaching staff. So if you think that and you're the athletic director, don't you call her in and say, look, I understand you want to leave. Here are our concerns. I'm going to spell it out to you and talk to her about it. And if at that point she insists to you, no, I'm making up my own mind, I think you have to believe her. How do you prove that you're not making up your own mind? You know, unless they had some sort of, you know, taped evidence of, you know, of some sort of collusion between other schools and the former coaches involving her, and in which case it's still You know, you're not going to punish the student athlete for something the former coaches are doing. So from the very beginning, you had a bad decision based on, I think, assumptions and some bad feelings between the former staff and the current athletic administration. And then you have a student athlete who gets caught in the middle of all that, and then Kansas State seemingly had no urgency in how to fix the situation. I mean, it took 2 months, and it took a lot of negative publicity and a lawyer getting involved before they could do what you just said initially was a common sense thing.
Last thing to wrap this up, for people that have not seen Romero play, can you just what kind of a game changer can she be for a program?
She's a really good player. She's a guard who can score. She's a good distributor. One of the things about her, you know, that I think helped make her such a good player as a freshman is she did play in the Spanish Pro League as an amateur for 3 years. So she's been around professional players. She understands the level of the professional game. She understands international basketball. Another element of this is that I think she's got very high aspirations for what she wants to do. She wants to play professionally. If not in the WNBA, then I think in Europe or certainly internationally. And she's part of the Spanish national team program. So she'll play in the European Under-20 Championships this year. And who knows? I mean, if she plays well enough, maybe she even gets a roster spot with Spain for the World Championships. That's how good a player she is. Does she have growth like any other freshman? Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what she'll be looking for, is to go to a place where she feels comfortable, where she gets to pick a staff. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that a player wants to say, hey, I decided about which people that I'm going to play for. I don't think that's wrong. I think when a school fires a coach or a coach leaves, I personally believe that if somebody wants to transfer, it should be automatically granted because the circumstances have changed. I hope for her sake that's what she finds, and she's able to do that. And then I hope Kansas State moves on with its program. You know, I mean, this was a black eye for them that they gave to themselves. And, you know, you'd like to see, just for the sake of women's basketball, because I do think they have a loyal fan base there, that they get past this and, you know, and both parties do okay. But this is definitely something where I feel like they created this scenario. They did not respect this young woman, and I don't think they ever thought it was going to become a big deal. You know, I think they thought everybody would just move on and ignore it, and that's not what happened.
Well, it certainly was quite captivating. Probably the one person that enjoyed this was the Shields, because they knocked her out of the transfer papers. Everybody talking about where she was going to go with all of this going on. That's still to be determined, and that will be another interesting saga to see where Diamond decides to take her talents.
Yeah, I wonder if she enjoyed it or didn't enjoy it. You know, you don't know. Diamond is somebody who does like some spotlight, and yeah, but you're right though that, you know, Diamond DeShields transfer situation I think would have dominated sort of the post collegiate season talk, that and obviously, you know, the normal recruiting chatter, and instead this whole, you know, Kansas State Romero situation Not only did it, you know, get so much attention, obviously, in the women's basketball community, but in the general sports community. It became a bigger issue because people kept looking at it and saying this doesn't add up. And I think people are always, it bothers them when they see a situation of somebody who's sort of been treated poorly and is sort of powerless against an institution that didn't need to do this. I think that's the other thing, because I heard from fans of, you know, others, UConn and Tennessee and, you know, Stanford. I mean, people nowhere near the Midwest who were bothered by just the power dynamics of the situation.
So moving on to so we can get on a few other topics. Like I said, we're just going to schmooze and talk random stuff now. You mentioned international play, which mm-hmm. is so important to her and such now. We haven't talked since the USA Basketball rounded out their staff for the senior national team. with Doug Bruno, Don Staley, and Cheryl Reeve. I personally don't think they could have done a better job. I thought that those are perfect people to have because Gino is buddy. It gives Staley and Reeve the opportunity to be the next on the totem pole for the future. You know, what do you think of the staff that they added to assist Coach Ariema?
I think it's very good. You have a coach right now that in the professional ranks is really at the top of the totem, as you say. Cheryl Reeves has been to the WNBA Finals the last 3 years, has won 2 championships, and I think really understands what it means to coach professional athletes. And, David, I think you and I have talked about this. That's a pretty young profession, really, you know, to be a professional women's basketball coach, to really grasp how you motivate people when they're not kids anymore, when they're grown women, they have a lot of different things going on in their lives, they play year round, to understand how to give them rest, when to push them, how to talk to them. Well, Cheryl Reeve really has studied that and understands that she is a professional women's basketball coach, and that's who she's going to be dealing with for the most part, is professional players. Then you have Doug Bruno, who's just been like a lifelong USA basketball guy. I mean, he's really been involved with USA basketball, and he's also a real ego-free guy. You know, he's the kind of guy that, you know, if he's going to do whatever is needed on that staff and do it, you know, very well. And Dawn Staley is, you know, one of the most decorated international women's basketball players the United States has ever had. Plus, I think, as you said, this sort of helps in terms of, I think most of us think at some point Dawn Staley may have an opportunity to coach the Olympic team and be the head coach, and this is a step in that direction.
Yeah, I would say at this point in time, of course, you never know what's going to happen, but you know, I would say confidently that Reeve or Staley will be next head coach of USA Basketball if Gina decides that he's had enough. But the other plus for Reeve, of course, is that she's probably going to be coaching 3 of her own players who, as we get into the WNBA side of things, you know, they're only averaging about 105 points, it seems, as the 3 of them, Augustus, Maya Moore, and Lindsay Whalen, and the rest of the team score 3 points, and they win by 4 or 5 every game. Things have been a lot of fun to watch, but because it's all offense, not much different.
Yeah, and I think part of that is Rebecca Brunson. It's such a crucial part of that defense. I think you could even say an anchor to that defense. So she's been out, and I think then they've had to adjust their style of play somewhat and, you know, had to basically say, okay, Maya, go out and score 30 points tonight, which she did, you know, for the first 4 games. But then you saw when Chicago, you know, did as much as they could to limit Maya, you know, in their game yesterday on Memorial Day, then you saw Lindsay Whalen step up more and be able to score. So, you know, when you've got a trio like that that are so good at playing off of each other, and then one of them obviously being the point guard and Lindsay Whalen, it is fun to watch, and it's got to be frustrating as heck to play, because I think Chicago did just about everything they could to win that game, and it still wasn't quite enough. That's, you know, that's what the Lynx have been doing is, you know, even we saw in Tulsa, that game came down to the wire. We're not seeing the Lynx at full strength right now, and they're still able to get these victories, which really, I think, has to make teams say, oh, my gosh, what happens when Brunson comes back? How good are they going to be then?
You know, the game when they beat Connecticut in overtime, when Moore went off and scored 20-something points in the first half, so then Augustus took over and made the game-tying overtime forcing basket. And then Whalen, who had been awful all game, then goes out and scores 10 points in overtime to win the game and basically be the hero single-handedly, so to speak. It's fascinating to watch them. And you mentioned the game against Chicago. I just thought a very interesting dynamic was watching Maya defend Deladon while Chicago wanted no part of that. and put Breland on Moore, one of the other forwards. Maya was working double time in that game.
Absolutely. And I think that shows one of the strengths of Maya as a player, and there are so many strengths of Maya as a player, but that's one of them, that she is willing to take a really tough defensive assignment. And it was interesting talking to her this past year during the WNBA Finals, where Maya was saying, you know, I really had to become a better defender. I really had to challenge myself, because defending the best three, you know, small forward players in the league, it's really hard. I mean, that those tend to be the best athletes, the most accomplished scorers in the league. And she said, you know, I had to, while still keeping my offense, I really had to make myself a better defensive player. And she's done that. But when you mentioned earlier about that, you know, Maya starts out in that game against Connecticut, and she plays great, and then Simone takes her part, and then Lindsay Whalen takes her part in leading the team, that's been such a big strength of this Lynx basketball team, you know, since they got really good, you know, 3 years ago, is how selfless these great players are. You know, if Simone had a different personality, let's say she was a little bit of a diva, it might have been tough for her to say, oh, wow, Lindsay Whalen comes in and she's the hometown girl, and Maya Moore comes in and she's the golden girl, and now I'm third on the list. Simone's never been like that. You know, all those years she kind of struggled being the face of a franchise that wasn't going anywhere, and then they go somewhere and she's, you know, third on the list of stars or whatever. She was fine with that. She just wanted to win. And we know Lindsay's the same way, and frankly, so is Maya. You know, that is those personalities. And I don't mean to sound like I'm gushing so much about the Lynx, because, you know, I know people maybe want to see them lose at this point, but I really have had a fun as somebody who loves women's basketball watching really good people, you know, people that have really good personalities and I think do things the right way, mesh as a team and play this well. I think it's really been cool to watch. And I'm not saying there aren't past champions that are like that. I think definitely, you know, there have been other championship teams that are like that. Seattle in 2010 was like that. And, you know, we've had some WNBA champions where I think there were more divas. We've had some teams where they had three or four divas, and it worked. So it can work the other way, but it is kind of fun to see a team of, you know, nice guys finish first.
You know, the other in the final minutes, the final seconds of that game last night against Chicago, I'm watching, and I the things you pick up on is they end up running a clear out, give Augustus the ball at the top of the key, and tell her to go. So it's certainly you know, Simone maybe as not a diva, but she certainly counted on to be, you know, when it's money time, they still give the ball to Simone, and I thought that was great to see. Because he is just lethal in those final seconds when she's got the ball and can hit the pull up from wherever she wants to be.
Yeah, and that's why I think if you're trying to come up with a defensive game plan against the Lynx, and again, right now you're looking at this and saying, how do we do this? Because you know, it's like you can do everything you can to try to shut down one of them, and then you can try to maybe shut down two of them. And when I say shut down, I mean like hold them under 30, right? So then there's a third one that can come up. And then there's, I think, the role players have been strong with Minnesota, even though their names have changed somewhat over these last three seasons. They do their job as well. So that's really, really tough. On the other hand, though, I do have to say, you know, I'm the dummy that picked Chicago to finish last in the East, because when I looked at, and you know how it's, what it's like, you know, that week before you have to make, you know, we have to pick, you know, how everybody's going to finish. And I mean, I kept going over and over and in my mind about, okay, well, what, you know, Sylvia Fowles is out for right now. We're not sure when she's going to come back. I'd heard that Epiphany Prince was going to be out. I don't know that it had been confirmed just yet, but there were rumors of that. Swin Cash wasn't coming back. So you looked at Chicago and thought, okay, I know they have Deladon, and she's great, But how is everybody else going to step up and play? I mean, and you know, Courtney Vandersloot was coming back too. But what about, you know, the middle, you know, and the power forward and the center position? And what we've seen is that Jessica Breland has played exceptionally well so far. And Della Don is, she's stronger, she's more decisive, she's even more of a leader. And that's good to see, too, because I think everything we saw in her rookie season, there's no sophomore let-up. You know, I mean, she's coming back out this season and being, you know, addressing all the things last year, I think, that she herself said were weaknesses, and she's already shown that she worked really hard on those, even though she didn't play overseas.
I know. To be fair to you, I mean, Jessica Breland and Sasha Goodland weren't exactly tearing it up over the rest of their career prior to this year. Now, Breland showed flashes with Indiana last year and all, but, you know, she bounced around, and she seems to be really just so improved in every aspect, but the most important aspect that I see is her confidence level is just unbelievable, and I do look at her and say, we had her in Connecticut for a little while, too, huh? And it's just a great story with all that this kid has been through for her to, you know, an opportunity like she's been presented and to just, you know, 11 rebounds a game right now. You know, it's just so impressive for, you know, somebody coming in new to the team and all.
One of the things, David, that I thought about for the last, you know, the WNBA season so far is looking at the situation Elena Delladon is in now compared to when she was at Delaware, where she is, you know, a big star, the star, and she's got teammates that are good basketball players, but not, you know, superstars, not like she would have been playing with at UConn. And she was able to elevate the whole team and do it in a way where I felt like her teammates did not resent her. They didn't, you know, act, oh, boy, all the attention always goes to Elena. They liked her. She's a good teammate. And now, obviously, at the WNBA level, she's also playing with a lot of really good players. But right now, she's not playing with as high a level player as, you know, she will be when you have some other people coming back. And yet she's doing the same thing. So I think it says something very, very good about what kind of teammate Elena Delladon is, because she's able to elevate the level of play around her. And also, I think she, you know, I think you have to give Pokey Chapman credit, I think, for helping with Breland's confidence. I mean, there's no question that, you know, that Pokey helps with that. But also Elena, you know, you think that has to be a part of it. And the thing, Dave, you know this, Pokey Chapman she's an emotional coach, you know. I mean, she motivates with emotion, but she's also somebody who's spent a lot of time now overseas and, you know, has coached at the overseas level. And so I think she's got a very good understanding now of what it takes X's and O's wise at the professional level. And so, you know, we're seeing all those things with Chicago. And you know, I'm very happy for Chicago. You know, you kind of want to see that franchise do well because their fans have, you know, been through some tough years. And now it looks like, you know, with Elena Delladon leading the way, they're you know, a pretty good franchise.
You know, I had a similar thought when you mentioned about the comparison to Delaware, because she was quoted either yesterday or the other day about saying that she's seeing more double, triple teams this in the past, which has surprised her because she was surprised she was so open this year. But seeing people, they now that respect of that time she can touch it. You know, that daring the others to make it. You're right. It's nice to see the story players, not just Breland, Goodland, Allie Quigley, who was always one of my favorites. You know, Paul and the whole family. I still get around with Bruno, you know, when's the next Quigley coming around? So it's good to see that team survive and have overcome any injuries. But Is it, should I be surprised that we're between 2 and 5 games into the season, and 4 teams in the East are below 500 and 4 teams are above 500?
In terms of how logjam-like the East is?
Just the fact that the West is starting to pull away and dominate already, and the East is still seeming to be the weaker sister.
No, because I think, in terms of should we be surprised? No, because that's the one thing, you know, I think almost everybody would have agreed on. I think even the East coaches, you know, would have said that. Bill Laimbeer, I think, has said that, you know, that there is just more overall talent, it seems like, in the West than in the East. And I don't know how if that's going to swing back around at some point. You would think it would have to in terms of maybe draft picks and, you know, other situations. But it definitely is, you know, it's a situation where I think you almost look at it and say, you know, the top three teams probably overall are in the West, and they're going to have to eliminate each other before the finals. So, you know, we've had that situation. You know, I think we've had that situation for the last few years, and I don't know when it's going to balance itself out. I'm really not sure when that's going to happen. And I guess the other thing in that is the draft lottery hasn't always – it hasn't gone in a way that necessarily balances things out. You know, that we've had against-the-odds things happen in the draft lottery, and that hasn't necessarily helped some of the teams in the East.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, you know, the Minnesota way of building the building through the draft by being lousy for a number of years certainly helped in terms of landing some of the players that they had. But, you know, I think Connecticut is looking to try that approach now. I'm not quite sure, but at least we started with Chene and Alyssa Thomas. Which leads me into my next thing, and you know, let's look at the rookies that we've been talking about, and Chene has been phenomenal. Thomas is doing her job. You got to look and say Natasha Howard and Choni Schimmel are really being very, very impressive new players to the league.
They are, and I think Natasha Howard was somebody that, you know, I was really confident in the draft that Indiana would take her. I mean, I really felt like they had done a lot of homework on her and felt like she was a player, and I hate to use those cliche terms like upside and all that kind of stuff, but that she was somebody who was just really beginning to scratch the surface of how talented she was. And I had the opportunity to cover Florida State in person during the NCAA tournament. So I talked to Sue Summerall a lot about her, and she said the same thing. She said, you know, we've developed her, but in some instances, you know, she will benefit from playing with some other really talented players. And I think we're seeing that. And also we're seeing that Indiana has to rely on her. You know, right now with Tamika Catchings being injured, Katie Douglas isn't there anymore. So they've sort of thrown her into the fire, and so far I think she's responded well. What you know, David, and I know, and I think all WNBA fans know, though, is then how will she deal with the adjustments that are going to be made to her? Because that's, you know, one of the keys for all rookies is you're new, people don't know you as well, and then they're going to make adjustments to stop you, and then you have to figure out how you adjust to the adjustment. With Choni Schimmel, I think the Atlanta was a good situation for her. You know, I think she didn't have to come in and be a superstar or even be a star. You know, she could come in, do her thing. There are a lot of good players on that team. They I think, have the most talent when everybody's healthy, probably collectively in the East. And so, you know, she's been able to benefit from that. And you know, that's good to see. I also think she just fits. You know, she has a little flair to her game, and I think that's a good place for her to, you know, to sort of exercise that.
You know, we've
seen. Did I say a little bit of flair? I'm sorry. She has a lot of flair. Sometimes I qualify things in a way I shouldn't. She has a lot of flair to her game, and so it's a good fit for her. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No. We certainly saw her in college a lot of times, and she must be the one thing I keep thinking when I've seen them play is she's got to be running back on defense to the defensive end saying, "Wow, people that can finish all the time." So this is unbelievable. We saw how many assists she could have had if somebody had managed to take it to the rim and actually score. And being on a team as talented as Atlanta, having those big, you know, those picks with Erica and Sandra Little finishing up, and of course Angel when she's been healthy, that's, you've got to be loving that absolutely for her. But you know, interesting that I was checking earlier today, and there's 5 rookies that are averaging over 30 minutes a game already, and none of them are named Sims or McBride. So it's really interesting, the people that are getting their time and playing the minutes, and that includes Dantas in Minnesota and Cruz in New York, the imports.
And those are the players, I think, that we obviously know a little bit less about, most of us, that don't see the European players or the overseas players as much. So the coaches, I think, have to do their homework on those players. And then, you know, we get a chance to see how they play in the WNBA. Not everybody adjusts as well. So far, they're doing really well. You mentioned Odyssey Sims. I can't help but think, you know, that although there was a lot of hype about Odyssey coming into Tulsa and, you know, how much they needed to, you know, get some more help from her, because I think a lot of people looked at Skylar Diggins as not performing as well last year as a rookie as maybe the expectations were. It seems like Skylar sort of took that to heart because she's played very well so far, and, you know, she's responded to the challenges. And I think that's interesting to see. And in terms of San Antonio, I sort of had a feeling with that team, it may take a while for Kayla McBride to really find her role. David, I can't think of any team in the WNBA that's more the team that is the sum of its parts, or the whole is probably going to be greater than the sum of its parts when they play well than San Antonio. Because when you look at the parts, there's some good parts there, and there's some people that play well. But I think that's more of a team where how they play as a unit is usually going to be more impressive than how any individual performs. And that may be, like I said, a team where it takes a little while for Kayla to find out, okay, how can I best impact this group? You know, where are the parts of the game that I can really help right away? Because it really is, I just think that's the type of team San Antonio is.
You know, they're always that dance, the disciple of the top of the school of, let me see if I can play everybody on my team between 15 and 20 minutes, and nobody gets tired. It's just killed me playing fantasy basketball over the years, ever having San Antonio players on my teams. But, yeah, I mean, it's a little tough to break a rotation of G. Perkins coming off the bench, Becky Hammond and Danielle Robinson in the backcourt, unless you're going to be getting a lot of minutes at the small forward position and competing there with Sophia Young-Malcolm getting some minutes down there too. So, yeah, Kayla's going to have to find her way, but, you know, I call it a hunt that she's going to do it. No question about it. You know, we talked about Breland and let's talk for a second. Some of the players that have been surprising this year, in addition to them, you mentioned Tulsa is going to, and everybody's going to say same old Tulsa, but you know they've lost by I think less than 5 points both games, one on the road to San Antonio and then to Minnesota, along with everybody else that they've played. How about the play that Diggins has started with this year? She has been just absolutely out of sight, and everybody was so nervous about her having a less than stellar start to her career, and then she didn't go overseas, and that's only 20 points a game.
Yeah, and I think there was I don't think that the concern was unwarranted because, you know, people, you know, were a little worried about, okay, is she going to how should I say that? You know, she's focused. She's got a lot of irons in the fire, I think is what I'm trying to say. She's very, very popular. She's got her Twitter following. She's got, you know, marketing and endorsement things. And so I think there was the thought of, okay, is she going to be more focused on her brand or on her basketball? And I think what we're seeing now is, you know, maybe Skylar's saying, you know, I can do both. You know, I can be a brand. I'm the Skylar brand, and I'm trying to really become that one of those breakout people, you know, that is known even above and beyond the WNBA, which I think all of us would say is a good thing for the WNBA. But also, I'm going to grow as a basketball player. And I think there are people who have questioned that, and whether that's, you know, fair or not. I think it's normal. We see it in the NBA. You know, we see some questions about, okay, is this player as committed to growing and becoming a better player as we hope they are? And I think so far, anyway, it's still early in the season. She has shown that, you know, that is something that she's really committed to. One thing, and you know this, David, because you saw so much of Skylar, especially against UConn, is Skylar, you know, if you challenge her, she's going to respond. You know, she's a very, you know, somebody who's got a lot of pride, and she's got a lot of, I would say positive view of, you know, how she thinks she can respond to situations. She is not somebody who has a lot of self-doubt. And so that's a good thing, too. In terms of, though, Tulsa overall, I keep waiting, you know, you keep thinking one of these years the breaks are really going to go their way. You know, it's just finally going to happen, almost like the way that it had for Minnesota, because, you know, for so many years Minnesota was, I would use the term, they were relentlessly mediocre for so many years, and then finally everything lined up right. I don't know if that's going to happen for Tulsa, but you know, you keep wondering if it is, you know, if the breaks finally are going to work, if they're going to play well enough, if they're going to win those games that come down to the wire, because they've certainly had a lot of them over the years against really good teams, and those games didn't go their way. We've already had, as you mentioned, the one against Minnesota that comes down to Maya Moore hitting free throws to beat them. So you kind of hope the fan base can continue to stay positive, although, you know, that's maybe asking a lot, but you also hope that players can continue to stay positive.
You know, what I like about Skylar this season is the fact that other than Deladon and Moore, she has more free throw attempts than anybody else in the league in only two games. She's got 17 foul shot attempts. That's more than Candace Parker had in three games. Now, that's the Skylar Diggins that drove me nuts as a UConn fan, because she would penetrate and she would get the calls. She knew what to do and knew how to get them. And last year she struggled with that. She was tending to get stuffed more. Now she's getting her body into position to absorb the contact. And I think that's a huge part of her game. And the other thing that Tulsa is, you can't overlook and the job that she's done in there for a couple. Granted, two games, let's see her do it for 10. But, you know, she's played some great ball.
And I think in terms of, you talked about with Skylar getting to the line, you know, that is something that it can take a while, certainly take a season at the professional level to understand how the game is called, to understand how you deal with the physicality of the game. And I think that's, you know, that's about really studying the game and studying film and, you know, putting in a lot of time in terms of really breaking down your performance, which I think Skylar's done that. I mean, it you're right, it is early on, but it just seems like she has a lot more confidence in what she needs to do to maximize what type of player she is. And you're right, that's when she was at her best in college, she was driving you nuts. You know, she was getting into the lane, she was she was making the right pass when it needed to be, but she was also taking on a lot of scoring responsibility. And, so far she's done that.
Now, one thing I wanted to wanted to bounce one theory off of you here. Now, we've talked about the big three for Minnesota and how difficult it is to contain them. When I look at them, the one thing that I notice that jumps out at me is all three of them have the capabilities and the ability to take the ball from one end of the court to the other. It's really difficult to stop a player over the course of a game when the ball's in their hands all the time. Now, there are some players that are infinitely more defendable, I think, because they can't handle the ball as well. So obviously the post players are the ones that come to mind. I think that an advantage is the fact that Elegant and Moore and Augustus, Whalen, all can bring the ball down and create their own shot on the fly. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think that's a really good point. And when you look back at, say, some of the best teams throughout WNBA history, you go back obviously to the very first champions, you had players like that in Cheryl Swoops and Cynthia Cooper that were so good at that, and whoever might have been playing point guard, there were different people that played point guard for them. So you had that with those teams. I think you look at the best of the Detroit Shock teams, and you had several players who could create for themselves, create for other people, but you're right, they could go end-to-end with the basketball. So that is really tough to guard. And then you add in that, especially in terms of Maya Moore and Simone Augustus, and this isn't to, because Lindsay Whalen is a really good athlete in her own right, but Maya Moore and Simone Augustus are supreme athletes. Maya sometimes still, and you know what I'm talking about, like she'll make a move and it's like powerful and graceful and artistic and athletic. Like you just look at it and say, she just looks differently sometimes doing stuff. It's like this, just the type of athlete she is. And you'd see that even when she was at UConn, the way that she could move through the air and some of the, how graceful she could look doing something that's very difficult and she could make it look easy. But you're actually right. Maya's handle is very good, So Maya can pull down a rebound and take it down the court and score on you, or she can pull down the rebound, take it down the court, and then throw a no-look pass to somebody. We saw her do that, in the game against Chicago, make some just brilliant feeds. So the fact that she can both do it, she can hurt you herself and be a playmaker, is, oh, my goodness, I don't know. And she's young, so I don't know how you stop her. I don't think you do. I don't know. I would not want to be in charge of trying to figure out how you beat Minnesota. I would be bad enough, with how you beat any team in the league, but I do not know how, when you sit down to try to break it down, I don't know what you do with them. I guess that's why I'm not a coach, right? Because I would say, I don't know.
That's why I think that we're looking at an eventual Minnesota or Los Angeles, because Parker can do it too, against mm-hmm. Atlanta as we head towards the finals, because McCautry can do it as well as the guards. And I think that as long as you've got that three-headed monster out there, meaning two regular guards and then a player like a Parker or a McCautry, or as we mentioned, even Deladon and Moore, as we mentioned before, I think that that's going to give you that extra advantage that some of these teams don't have. Phoenix, yeah, Bonner has a pretty good handle, just not the same to me. I look at their rotation and their players. Same thing with just about everybody else out there. I mean, those are the three or four teams that I see with the difference makers, the abilities to handle the ball and create for themselves.
And when you look at you know, there's a long way to go, obviously, to the end of the season. But when you look at the situation like a Phoenix is in, if they're in a position where, let's say, they're second or third, it's, you know, let's say Minnesota wins and Phoenix is second and L.A. third or vice versa, then the position Phoenix is in is to try to beat two teams that are like that, to try to beat an L.A., which has a great playmaker and great athlete, great scorer in Parker, and do the same against Minnesota. If they have to beat both of them, which they're in that situation last year. And that's what makes it really tough for Phoenix. You know, if Phoenix was in a position where maybe they win the Western Conference, which I don't think is going to happen, but if they did, and then they only have to beat one of them. You know, if L.A. and Minnesota eliminate, one of them eliminates the other, and Phoenix doesn't have to beat both of them to make the finals, that would be a much better situation for Phoenix. But that's a tough, you just nailed it. Why that's such a tough situation, as good as Phoenix is, for Phoenix to try to make it to the finals. And then let alone whoever ends up finishing fourth in that league, you know, that then they're even further, you know, behind the eight ball, I think, in trying to make it to the finals. And then meanwhile, on the other side, I do think that's why, once again, you know, where, you know, I picked, and I think probably a lot of people picked Atlanta for the very reason that you said, is, A, they do have a lot of talent. When healthy, I think they have the most talent, and they have a player like that, an Angel McCautry. She's a playmaker who can also absolutely kill you with her scoring. And then, and is it can be absolutely one of the best defenders in the league. So that just those three teams right there have something that just makes it so hard. So if we get a repeat of Atlanta, Minnesota, who's going to be surprised? And I'm not. And then if we get a repeat of what happened with Atlanta and Minnesota, that Minnesota wins again, who's going to be surprised? I think one thing that could that will help. Certainly as if Sancho Little is healthy and throughout the season and able to play. And, you know, that they have that combination of Sancho Little and Erica DeSouza and Angel. If they have all those players, I think that at least helps them match up better against Minnesota. But I know we're going way ahead to the end of the season. It might not happen, but right now if it does, you know, right now I still put Minnesota as being in the driver's seat.
I agree with you 100%. I mean, if Phoenix can somehow, you know, turn back the clock a couple of years and get a healthy Penny Taylor back on the court, that's a difference right there that elevates them right into that same category as having that extra person, because, you know, you certainly want Taurasi on the court for you if a game's on the line. But, you know, the game they had against L.A., though, there were cracks in the foundation. For the first time, I saw Diana turn the ball over and throw it away and just not play well down the stretch. I mean, that's everything that just the last thing I wanted to touch on is we talked about the rookies, but, you know, Katie Douglas is under 10 points a game. Mika's missing time with injuries. Are we seeing a change start? Y'all getting old finally?
I always wonder, like, if, you know, with all the players you mentioned, like, if the decline of certain players, if you're going to see it more dramatically than you are with others. And, you know, I think of, like, in baseball, it happens sometimes that literally you go from one season to the next and the player's just done. We see that with pitchers, I think, especially. But you also see it with hitters where maybe the decline was more gradual, you didn't see it as much, and then it's just, you know, you go from one season to the next, and you just know that guy's finished. I don't know if that happens as much in basketball, but the bottom line is one of these years, Tamika Catchings and Diana Taurasi and Katie Douglas, I mean, one of these years, and Diana's a little younger than those first two, they are going to – the careers are going to eventually come to an end. Their effectiveness is going to come to an end. And I don't know when, like I said, if we're going to see that more in a gradual thing or, you know, if it's just going to, you know, become evident, you know, in a season. And I think then we add in the fact that you do have some players right now who are in their, you know, mid to late 20s that just physically are still in the peak years as athletes. And Maya Moore, obviously, Angel McCautry are two examples of that. It's, you know, they're at that zenith, if you will. What is it they say about you know, in sports is you'll hit your zenith usually in your late 20s, and then it's a matter of staving off the decline. You know, who's the best at, you know, not declining quickly? And so I think we may be seeing some of that. So, you know, we'll see. It's the positive thing that I see is you see in a lot of younger players that ability to handle the ball, to be playmakers, to shoot from the outside, to post up. You know, the best player right now, we all know, in the college game, Breanna Stewart, is like that. We see some younger players that are coming up that are like that. That is becoming a type of player. And even 10 years ago, you just didn't see that much. You know, I mean, there wasn't, and there certainly wasn't multiple versions of that player. So I think that's an exciting thing. And we're seeing that this season in the WNBA. We've seen it now in college. That's a step further that the women's game takes.
You know, it was just a couple of years ago that I was, you know, talking about the renaissance of the centers, because we had Breyer coming up and Charles and Fowles and DeSouza, you know, real legitimate back to the basket centers. And of course, I always complained that people don't know how to feed the post well enough. Well, as soon as that came, it's going. And you're right. We've got the 6'4", 6'5", girls like Davidson and Stewart that are all face-up players now. And it really is a lot of fun to be able to see those types of things out of them. So I'm sure that this will continue to be great for the game, no question about it. Well, Michelle, I probably have about 20 more things I'd love to discuss with you, but I think that we've taken this about as far as we can take it for tonight. So I just want to say thanks for taking time and being a part of this. It's always great to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate having the opportunity, because it's fun to talk to you too. And, you know, I enjoy the evolution of the game. That's been, you know, for all the years I've covered women's basketball, people say, what is it that I've most liked about my job? It's been watching the game grow up, because it really has. And, you know, I wasn't bored with the game in the early 80s when I was watching it. I liked it then. And then watching it grow up, you know, through the, you know, almost like 30 years now that I've covered it, it's been really fun, and it's been very rewarding to see how players have evolved and developed, and how coaching has evolved and developed, without the game losing, I think, the parts of it that I really like, which is the down-to-earth nature, I think, of a lot of the players, the approachability of the players. Those things, in my mind, haven't changed a whole lot, or certainly not drastically, but the game itself has gotten better. That's pretty cool.
I agree 100%, and we definitely have some outstanding young women in the game. You know, notably, one thing I just have to mention before we go is, you know, the public stances of people like the Aguma case with the situation in Nigeria being front and center and trying to educate people. Brittany Griner, you know, with her rainbow approach to basketball and just trying again to educate people. And I just think that's just wonderful. And of course, Tamika Catchin has been, you know, the epitome of what you're supposed to do without giving back to the community.
Absolutely. And, you know, the fact that the players stay in school for 4 years, for almost universally, that's a big thing, because they grow up. I think they develop a lot emotionally and socially. And then, you know, going overseas, I think, also has been a good thing, even though I know everybody worries, myself included, about how this breaks down people's bodies and the fact that they have to play so much. And that is something that over the next 10, 15 years, I think we're still going to be concerned about. But the positive is we've had a lot of people that go overseas, and I think it broadens their horizon. They just bring back a lot from having undergone that experience. And I also think they're extremely good ambassadors when they're overseas. You know, they're people that we're proud of representing us overseas. So that's also something I think is notable about professional women's basketball.
Well, again, thank you for your time. And, of course, your opinions are always impeccably honest and refreshing. And I appreciate it. And I know my listeners do, too.
Glad to talk to you, and I appreciate anybody who listens to me for an hour. So I appreciate it.